A reading from the book of Isaiah. There will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shined. You have multiplied the nation. You have increased its joy. They rejoice before you. As with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For all the boots of the tramping warriors and all the garments rolled in blood shall be burned as fuel for the fire. For a child has been born for us, a son given to us. Authority rests upon his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, and there will be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness, and from this time onward and forevermore, the zeal of Yahweh of hosts will do this. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, according to Matthew.
Glory to you, Lord Jesus Christ.
When Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew to Galilee. He left Nazareth and made his home in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. The land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, on the road by the sea, across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. From that time, Jesus began to proclaim, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near." The Gospel of Christ.
The passage that you heard Donna read this morning from Isaiah chapter 9 probably started giving you some Christmas thoughts. Because when we read those words of "unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given," that's where we go. As Christian readers of the scriptures, this is one of those passages where we think, hey, that's just all about Jesus. And in Christian interpretation, yes, it is. But if that is all that the passage is about, we are getting ahead of ourselves. One of the things that we always have to remind ourselves is that the Hebrew Bible was written first. It outlines the context into which Jesus was born, and it is after Jesus has done his thing that we are able to look back at the scriptures and see what connections might be made. When Isaiah the prophet was saying these words, I'm going to suggest to you he wasn't thinking about Jesus at all. In fact, it's highly unlikely he had any idea of anything beyond what it was he was initially talking about. Now, and of course, when I say that, one might think, well, wait a minute, Derwin, what are you doing with the scriptures here? Well, once again, let's just take it step by step. It is the Reign of Christ Sunday. It is sometimes called Christ the King Sunday today. And I am going to say that there is indeed a connection here. But it'd be helpful for us to understand what is being said initially to understand how we can see this connect with Jesus. And so we begin with the prophet Isaiah in the first place. He ministered for about 40 years as a prophet. I don't recall if we can know how old he was when he got started, but in Isaiah chapter 6, he says that it was in the year that King Uzziah died that he received his call to be a prophet. And that happened in 740 BCE. In 722 BCE, the Assyrian Empire came in and conquered the northern kingdom of Israel and completely wiped it off the map. Isaiah was a prophet to the southern kingdom of Judah, with its headquarters in Jerusalem, with its capital city in Jerusalem. And so this was something that he and the others living in the south were able to witness about the northern kingdom. The thing is, though, that once the Assyrians took the northern kingdom of Israel, they didn't just all of a sudden say, oh, okay, that's good, let's take our toys and go home. They were interested in finishing the job and taking the entire region, which would then include the southern kingdom of Judah and its capital of Jerusalem. The Assyrians were a threat to Judah in this time. And here we're talking around 715 BCE. The Assyrians began to advance onto the southern kingdom, and as they were doing so and cleaning up, you know, their work as they were dealing with the northern kingdom, the people of Judah were all too aware of the threat that was coming to them. And it came to the point where they were surrounded by the Assyrian army. The city of Jerusalem had Assyrians all around them. And the scriptures tell us this in 2 Kings chapter 18 and 19. This is where we get the story here. And this event is taking place during the reign of King Hezekiah. Now, Isaiah serves several kings. He starts off with serving Uzziah, then a later king is Ahaz or Ahaz. He's sometimes called. Hezekiah comes a bit later. And what Isaiah is describing in chapter 6 is what it was that had been happening to the southern kingdom of Judah because of this threat from Assyria. I mean, he begins by saying, there will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. What he's talking about there is two of the tribes of Israel that were from the northern kingdom. So looking back to 722 BCE, he says there was a time that contempt was brought in this northern kingdom. He's referring to the defeat of Israel by the Assyrians. But then he says that in latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea, the Galilee of the nations. He's saying that there will be some kind of restoration to the northern kingdom at some point. But he's acknowledging at the time that he's writing that it is defeated. It is completely dealt with. And then he begins to talk about the people around him. He begins to speak to those who were living in Jerusalem. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shined. What he's talking about is the fact that the Assyrian army had encircled the city of Jerusalem, that Judah was in danger of falling as well. But he's talking about this in the past tense. And he's saying that a light has shined upon them. And then he goes on, speaking of God, you have multiplied the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. This is a good news time. Why? Because he says the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. So a couple of things here. This day of Midian, what is that all about? Well, that takes us back to the period of the judges, when a man named Gideon was raised up by God and an angel of Yahweh appeared to him and told him to be strong and courageous and to resist the Midianites who were attacking Israel. And if you remember the story, Gideon is saying, okay, I'll do this, and where's the army I need? Because the army of the Midianites was something like 10,000 people. And so God led Gideon through this interesting process that whittled down his army to only 300 guys. And he said, trust me, we're going to make it happen with this. And so the Midians are camped out one night, and Gideon had the 300 men, each one holding a trumpet and a torch that was covered over by an amphora, by a jar. And then at a signal, they broke their jars and blew their trumpets, waking up the Midianites, and they wake up, and in the darkness, they just see they're surrounded by these torches, and they're fearful that they've got a huge army surrounding them, and they just go nuts and end up killing each other, and that's how the Midianites are defeated. And Israel is delivered. And Isaiah is saying, as in the day of Midian, this is what Yahweh has done as well. Well, what is it that happened? Well, in 2 Kings chapter 18 and 19, we learn that when the Assyrian army came and encircled Jerusalem, there were 186,000 troops. Now, I suspect that that number is greatly inflated. Having that number of people in an army in that day and age is an insane thing to think about. There's some exaggeration going on here. But there was a huge army around Jerusalem. Hezekiah, this righteous king, who was doing things right, who feared Yahweh and all of those things like a king is supposed to, called out to Yahweh and asked for deliverance. And Yahweh delivered Israel. The army of the Assyrians was wiped out. And they're all dead. They're done. The threat is gone. And this is the most significant military victory that Israel has had since the story of them crossing the Sea of Reeds and the Egyptian army led by the Pharaoh being defeated. This is the most significant victory in the history of Israel, was this defeat of the Assyrian army that had threatened Jerusalem. And so in Isaiah chapter 9, Isaiah is celebrating what has happened, that this has gone. The people who were in darkness, the people in Jerusalem surrounded by this enemy, is now no longer an issue. Their oppressor has been defeated. And he goes on to say, for a child has been born for us, a son given to us, authority rests on his shoulders, and he is named Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His authority shall continually grow. Who Isaiah is talking about here is King Hezekiah. He's talking about the fact that they had this righteous king, and it is all past tense, by the way. A son has been born to us. A child has been given to us. This one who was born, who became the king Hezekiah, was exactly the kind of king Judah needed, and Assyria was stopped dead in its tracks because of his righteousness and his willingness to submit to Yahweh. This passage is a celebration of King Hezekiah. Now, I've looked at interpretations of this passage from a Jewish rabbi who doesn't believe that Jesus is the Messiah. I've looked at the interpretation of this passage by two guys who are Messianic Jews, so they're still Jewish, but they do believe Jesus is the Messiah. And of course, I'm rather familiar with Christian interpretations of this passage. And any significant interpretation will acknowledge Isaiah is talking about Hezekiah here. And so what the prophet is saying is we are celebrating this great news of what Yahweh has done for us, how we have been delivered, and it is through the leadership of Hezekiah. Now, those who hear that would say, okay, wait a minute, though. Like, it says, though, that this child, his name will be Mighty God, Wonderful Counselor, all of these things. How can this be? Well, without going into tremendous detail on the grammar there for the sake of time and all of that, let me just simply remind us all that what you will see throughout the Hebrew Bible is that people are given names that are meant to illustrate a circumstance, a situation, or even say something about God himself, right? Elijah's name is Yahweh is my God. Hezekiah's name means God is mighty. You have names like Isaiah, which means Yahweh saves. These meanings of these names are not about the person who holds the name, but they are saying something about the God that they represent. We see in other situations, in the previous chapter, chapter 8, Isaiah's son, Meher Shalal Hashbaz, who I think has the longest name in the Hebrew Bible, his name is speaking to a particular circumstance that means the spoil speeds, the prey hastens. And it's talking about Assyria. And so Isaiah names his kid about the fact that Assyria is on its way. There's another one, Eli the priest, back in the days of Samuel. His grandson's name is Ichabod, because Ichabod means the glory has departed. And he was so named after the Philistines came and took the Ark of the Covenant out of the temple. And so his grandson was named Ichabod to illustrate that event. So the fact that this king, Hezekiah, would be given a name that includes these titles descriptive of God would not be a surprise at all. Mighty God, Wonderful Counselor, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, these are all attributes of God, Yahweh, the God of Israel. Hezekiah is who is being talked about here. And when you think about it, that makes total sense. If Isaiah is going to be talking to encourage the people, to bring to attention what it is that has happened, to what it is that they can look forward to in spite of the challenges that they've been facing, may I ask you, how good would it be for him to say, hey, I just want you to know that 700 years from now, a baby is going to be born and make everything perfect? That'd be like me saying today, it's kind of hard. We're dealing with a lot of issues with our government and our economy and climate change and all that kind of stuff. But don't worry, in 2724, Canada will have a prime minister who will do everything right. That is 17 or 18 generations away. How much good would it do for you right now to know that, hey, don't worry about it because your great, 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 great grandson will finally have the prime minister we need today? It's going to be of limited encouragement. Isaiah is speaking to his audience and he's speaking about this great king, Hezekiah, who has led them well. However, the passage doesn't remain in the past tense. When we get towards the end of this, he does begin to say, there shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. Well, there certainly was peace in the time of Hezekiah, but it didn't become endless peace. There did end up being more conflict, and 150 years later, the kingdom of Judah, the city of Jerusalem, will be defeated, will be destroyed by the Babylonians. But he goes on and says, he will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time onward and forevermore. The zeal of Yahweh of hosts will accomplish this. So we see this future tense now that's introduced that obviously is pointing people towards the future nevertheless. And as time goes by and they discover that things aren't quite happening the way that Isaiah said it was going to happen, they start to think there must be something more to this. And I do not know if this is the first passage to begin this expectation, but it certainly is one of the earlier passages to begin to build into the Jewish mindset this messianic expectation, this idea that there is an anointed one who would come, who would indeed fulfill the things that are in the future tense that are talked about here, that would act in a way that was very similar to how Hezekiah led as a good king on the throne of David, and that this anointed one that they expect would indeed be on the throne of David, would be a king of Israel, would be one who would give leadership to the benefit of the nation. And so this expectation of this anointed one, this messianic expectation, if it didn't begin with this passage, it certainly helps bring it about. And by the time that Jesus is born, that messianic expectation is great in the country of Israel, in the kingdom of Israel. And of course, at the time Jesus is born, the Roman Empire is occupying and oppressing Israel. And the word saying he has thrown off the rod of the oppressor, he has broken the yoke of burden, they begin to long for that to happen again. Now, when Jesus is born, nobody cares. There's no great sense of anything about Jesus being born. Nobody knows anything about this child. When Jesus emerges at age 30, though, and begins to preach and to teach, now he becomes noteworthy. And when he does his ministry, people then realize this guy is really significant. And we even see written in the Gospels, people saying, could he be the Messiah that we've been waiting for? Could he be the one that we're expecting one day? And when the time came for the Gospel of Matthew to be written, I know we've been reading the Gospel of John lately, but only Matthew quotes Isaiah 9, so I picked the passage from Matthew. When the Gospel of Matthew was written at least 40 years after Jesus was alive and doing his thing, he makes this connection. After 4 decades of thinking on the part of the Israelites and about the people who were following Jesus, they came to the conclusion that he indeed was that Messiah that was promised. So that's why when we heard in our gospel this morning, when Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew to Galilee to the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, which of course is what Isaiah 9 had been talking about. That's what even makes the point of saying this was so that what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. And then he begins to speak the beginning verses of this passage that we read already. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and for those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. So Matthew is making the connection retrospectively with Isaiah, saying, I want to make the point that Jesus is the Messiah that we were anticipating. And I can see a connection here with where Jesus is living. And of course, Matthew's looking back, looking back at what has already happened in Jesus' life. And when he sees the significance and the growth of the gospel and all of these things, he's saying, how can this be anybody but the Messiah that was expected? And look at where he lives. You know what? I see a connection with Isaiah 9. Now again, Isaiah would have had no idea about a boy named Jesus who was going to be born and grow up and do this thing. There's no hint of that. He is giving a promise that Yahweh will remain faithful to Israel and bring restoration at some point. And after Jesus has emerged, we are able to see and look back and go, we can make a connection there with that promise. And so what we have done is taken the entire chapter, and in light of Jesus' birth, thought, you know what? This fits. A child has been born to us. A son has been given. And it becomes a popular thing for us to think about at Christmas time. It isn't quite the perfect fit we would like it to be, actually. But it does speak to the promise of Yahweh's faithfulness. And so for us, on this day, the Reign of Christ Sunday, Christ the King Sunday, in acknowledging that Jesus is the Messiah, and of course the word Christ is simply the Greek version of the Hebrew title Messiah, we are acknowledging that Jesus is the one who was promised to sit on David's throne, as it were, to be the king, as it were. And today, we continue to live with a certain level of messianic expectation. Because just as the people in Isaiah's day were thinking there is a fulfillment yet to come, and who knows when it will be, but we're looking for it, in the same way today, we're doing the same thing. One of the key themes of the Reign of Christ Sunday is to be anticipating when we might see the reign of Christ in a huge way in the world, where we see the world operating according to what it is that the gospel of Jesus Christ has described it ought to be, where we would see people no longer at war with one another. We would see people embracing each other in love for the unity we share in our humanity, where we would see ourselves treasuring the earth and all that is in it as part of the good creation of God. That day has not yet come, but we're looking forward to it. It's called by a variety of things. The Greek term for it is parousia. We sometimes talk about the second coming of Christ. We sometimes talk about the return of Jesus. And there's all sorts of debate exactly what that looks like and how it's going to play out. The key thing is it has not yet happened. And we are looking forward to that reality. And so Isaiah chapter 9 gives us reason from the experience of Israel expecting and anticipating the arrival of their Messiah, which we believe has happened in Jesus, to now in a similar way be anticipating the fulfillment of the promise that the reign of Christ would be demonstrated in our world. So between now and then, there's not much value in counting generations. It's kind of fun, but there's not really any value in doing it. Instead, let us be looking for the kingdom that Jesus described. Let us be looking for the characteristics of the reign of Christ that we read about in the scriptures. And let us consider what it is that we might do to help bring it about. Be because the reign of Christ is characterized by people walking in the way of Jesus, walking in the way of justice, walking in the way of care and concern for all. And so we obviously have to do that. And so let us do our part in seeing this vision fulfilled and seeing the fulfillment of the expectation that we enter into now as we start the season of Advent next week. Amen.